Hello, fellow humans. The following is a conversation with Dr. Elon Barinholtz, cognitive scientist and AI researcher, and it might just change the entire way you think about language, learning, and even the mind itself. What if large language models like ChatGPT aren't just engineering marvels, but point to something about how our minds work? In this episode, we explore a radical idea that language isn't grounded in meaning the way we think it is. Instead, words may be more like musical notes in a melody, a pattern of predictions unfolding over time, shaped by use rather than rules. Dr. Barinholtz lays out his provocative theory that human language operates on a simple recursive process called autoregression, where one output becomes the next input. We also dig into what this means for speech therapy, for memory, for kids growing up immersed in screens, and for how we should think about teaching language. This was an extremely fun one. So, what lies beyond the words we speak? Tune in and find out. Hey everyone, welcome to Beyond Words, conversations on language, music, and mind in collaboration with SpeechTherapyPD.com. I'm your host, Garrett Oyama. I'm a musician practicing SLP and a PhD student with an interest in all things language, music, and cognition. And I'm super excited that we have the one and only Dr. Elon Barinholtz here with us today. Dr. Barinholtz is an associate professor of psychology at Florida Atlantic University, where he also co-directs the Machine Perception Cognitive Robotics Lab and the Visual Mind Lab. And correct me if I'm getting any of these things wrong.
So far, you're doing better than I usually do.
Great. His research spans human and machine perception, learning, and cognition, with a focus on how intelligent systems, biological or artificial, acquire structure and meaning from the world. Dr. Barinholtz's work bridges cognitive science and artificial intelligence, addressing topics such as visual processing, pattern recognition, consciousness, and most recently, theoretical models of language as an autoregressive system. And just before we get started, just a couple of items to mention. Most of these upcoming podcasts, including today's, will include an accompanying course on Speech Therapy PD that is available for 0.1 ASH CEUs. Just a couple of necessary disclosures. We each receive an honorarium from Speech Therapy PD for this podcast, but there are no other relevant non-financial disclosures to report at this time. So without further ado, Dr. Barinholtz, welcome to Beyond Words.
Thank you so much. Really exciting to be here.
I always ask the guests a little bit about their origin story because it's always so interesting to see, you know, how they've gotten to where they are today. So, you know, what got you into this field?
So it's interesting you should ask. So I jumped into what I guess traditionally can be called cognitive science. My degree was technically in was in cognitive science, and cognitive science is a sort of sprawling, multidisciplinary kind of field. And I jumped into it because I was looking for actually a theory of mind. And by a theory of mind, I meant really something, you know, akin to what we, you know, the great scientific theories, like theory of evolution by natural selection or theory of genetic inheritance and things along those lines, all encompassing theories that explain lots and lots of phenomena in a neat way that you can say, hey, we figured something out here. And thought about philosophy because I was really interested in the mind, consciousness, actually, in particular. I thought about psychology because I was really interested, really more scientifically oriented, and I thought empiricism was the way to go. And I kind of found myself in the middle. I said, okay, let me plot a course that's somewhere that doesn't quite fit into either of those. And I spent the past, I don't know, a couple of decades or more, actually, you know, sort of engrossed, ensconced in this fairly nebulous kind of state between theorizing about the mind and then doing empirical experimentation and computational experimentation to try to understand what all this data meant. And frankly, I was deeply disappointed, both in my own research. It wasn't so much that I didn't feel like I'd perform as I was hoping, but really because the field itself, in some ways, really was casting about without a real clear direction. This phenomena, collecting lots and lots of data with some computational modeling here and there to try to, usually to capture sort of low-level processes, physiological processes, or maybe very high-level like Bayesian, trying to capture all the fact that we incorporate information, you know, in a kind of robust way and things like that. But nothing that I would have actually called a true theory. And so I had actually, to some extent, resigned myself to the fact that, no, I guess we're not really going to get anywhere, or at least I'm not personally going to get anywhere in my ultimate goals. And then AI dropped. And I had been following this for a long time. I spent a lot of time in graduate school being told that that neural networks weren't going to really work. And, you know, it was called connectionism at the time. And I largely believe this to some extent. I just kind of wrote it off. But somewhere around 2012, between 2012 and 2015, neural networks started to do the things that we called cognition. At least visual cognition started to really get solved. They could do things like labeling, identifying objects and things like that, and then maybe also navigation and things along those lines. And this was of great interest to me. I basically reoriented and said, "Hey, I need to start focusing on this. This looks like it has the germ of a theoretical framework, because a neural network is a mathematical framework that says, input output. Here's a function. Maybe that is it's a way of actually modeling the brain." And then large language models dropped, about 3, 4 years ago, and this blew my mind, blew a lot of people's minds, but mine in particular. For me, this was kind of like, oh, it was beyond just saying, "Here we have, something that mimics or simulates aspects that we're trying to model in of cognition." But there was a deeper insight here, this autoregression thing that really, really woke me up. And I describe it as an epiphany that the recipe for cognition might actually be inherent in this particular algorithmic approach of having a function, take some input, produce an output, take that output, put it back into the input, and then feed it through itself. And it basically captures so much and so deeply sort of the basic intuitions we have about what the mind really is, to the point where now I think it's not lo no longer even believe it's just the theory of language, which I do believe. I think it's exactly how we do language to a large extent, but probably a theory of the mind more broadly, which means I've come full circle. In some mysterious, haphazard way, I ended up finding exactly what I set out to do. I wish I could take credit for and say I designed this solution, but I do take a little bit of credit for the fact that I was looking for it for a long time, and I think I've spotted it in a way that almost nobody else seems to have yet. I mean, I haven't seen many people making the claim that the mind itself and language production, even specifically, is actually in humans is exactly the same algorithmically, exactly the same thing as what these models are doing. So that a computational equivalent, this argument of computational equivalence. And so that's, sorry, I know that was a very long-winded introduction, but it sort of takes us to the present moment as to what it is I'm so excited about, what I'm out there talking about. And it was really, and in some ways, looks like a meaningful trajectory and arc. And it was. It was, in a sense, I set out to understand this broad thing we call the mind and the brain. Not just as a patchwork of, here's a certain phenomenon, here's a certain sub-module in the brain that does this, and another one does that. What I think is going on is that we now have a framework to understand what the system is doing. The same way we understand the heart, what its function is, and the way we understand, the liver, what its function is, in conjunction with other organs, but each one has its own function. I think we now may have a framework for understanding the brain and what its function is. I mean, it doesn't just mean to think and to behave intelligently, but now it's at a more concrete level. It's like the brain, the heart keeps us alive, sure, but it does it through, a process of applying a kind of dynamics to hemodynamics and so that it pumps blood and blah, blah, blah. Same thing with the brain. It's doing this kind of predictive process, this generative process, taking in inputs, producing outputs, and then feeding them back into themselves. So that's sort of the whole story in a nutshell of kind of where I ended up really kind of focusing very, very strongly on this kind of specific aspect of artificial intelligence, particular language, and how I think this ties into the broader concept of behavior, cognition, whatever you want to call it.
Wow, incredible. Yeah, it's a really deep and profound insight. And when I heard your interview on theories of everything, it really opened my mind to different ways of thinking about speech therapy. And I just want to make sure that all the SLPs who maybe are less technical, we get
Yeah,
a
and I'm
good sense
sorry.
of.
I apologize if I'm throwing a lot of jargon.
Not at all. This is perfect. Yeah, and I think that there are a ton who are following, language development or just language cognition more broadly. So I think this is going to be aimed at them. I just want to make sure that we maybe a couple of the terms that we can define, one being in this theory of language specifically and cognition more broadly, which is really exciting. I want to talk about that later. But yeah, starting with language, you mentioned that it's this autoregressive system that you have these inputs and they feed back into each other. Can you just give a brief, the kind of simplified definition for SLPs
Okay.
who might not be familiar with, LLMs?
Absolutely. And I use that word so often. People make fun of it. They make drinking games out of it. I should just define it right off the bat. But it's basically the following. The idea is that you have a function. And a function is just, we all know about functions. You have an input and an output. An input could be, like a set of numbers, Let's say you could have, a simple function would be you take two numbers and you give me the sum. You take two numbers, you give me, the product, right? That's a simple idea of a function. It's a mapping. And you can build a computer system that does this, that produces this kind of function. Now, in the case of autoregression, there's one extra step. And that's it. Instead of just saying you take an input and produce an output, the trick is you take that output and then tack it on to the original input and then feed it in again. And then you produce another output. And so what you've got is a function, really just the sort of core computational structure. The thing itself, you could think of it as a computer or a recipe, an algorithm. You could write it down, however you want to write down or describe this thing that takes inputs and produces outputs. But you've got that thing, right? And then you take that thing and you do this autoregression, namely, you take its output and you feed it back into itself. And so this is the idea of recursion, right? That you're taking an output, feeding back in, like the Ursa, really, like the snake eating its own tail. But you don't just feed it its own output again, because if you just kept doing that, you'd just end up in a sort of attractor and you'd end up someplace very uninteresting. But what you're doing in the case of autoregression, in particularly with like large language models, is you're taking that output and you're tacking on to the previous inputs, right? So if I give a large language model, I say, hey, tell me a story. Okay, so it takes that input, tell me a story. And what it's going to do is that's its input and it's going to produce an output. That output in the case of large language models is what do you think the very next, it's called a token, but you can think of it as a word. What do you think the very next word should be? So if I say to you, Garrett, tell me a story, you might be like, okay, once upon a time, right? So the first thing you'd say is okay, right? You take that okay, and then you take that okay and tack it onto the tell me a story. Okay, you have that sequence, stick that in, run it again. Now you take the same function. Same exact function, very important, right? The same function, but it's a new input because now it has the word okay at the end. Stick it in. Now you say okay once. And now you say once, and then you feed that whole thing in again. And then you say okay once upon, right? And so what's happening is this thing is generating its own inputs, right? And it's doing this in a sequential manner so that it's building up these incremental inputs. And then that's the whole trick. So this single function. The function isn't thinking about further tokens, not thinking about the whole sequence. Its job is just to do one thing. Tell me the next token. But by doing it autoregressively, by doing it, feeding it back into itself, you end up with this process. It's not the function itself is just a function, input, output, but function plus autoregression gives you a process, and that process then can give you infinite length sequences, right? It can tell you a story, it can write a book. It can give you a long explanation on any esoteric topic you want, but it's doing it all of this just based on this very, in some ways, very simple predictive model. And so that's the sort of core concept of autoregression. Regression just means, prediction, basically. Like you may be familiar with like linear regression. You've got a bunch of data, and you're trying to based on that, you're trying to plot some new data point. And so you regress a line and you come up with a model based on this. Here's my predictive model. So it's sort of a predictive model and it's autoregression, right? Because it takes its prediction, feeds it back into itself, and then does it again. And that's sort of the whole magic of autoregression.
Got it. Yeah, and that really helps clarify. One thing in the interview that you mentioned that was, related to this, but really blew my mind was that, you made this connection between LLMs having no actual grounding in the world to meaning, which is, it's the traditional way we think about language, that meaning is grounded in something. And then, saying that it's really just doing this autoregression where the snake eating its own tail is a great kind of an image for that. But that, rather that meaning comes from, not grounding, but this like sort of shape of the web of, relationships between other words. So you mentioned this like this high dimensional latent space of sorts. It sort of made me think about this. It kind of like music, right? So, one note by itself, it doesn't mean anything. It has no meaning. But then it's, as it moves along through the song, meaning kind of emerges through these relationships. And, the shape of the musical, the sonic structure of music, it has all these, built-in shapes that we don't typically think of. But as you are a musician, you learn about music, you get these intuitive senses of how notes come to fit together and things like that. Are you saying that language is perhaps something like this?
That is so apt. I can't begin to tell you. I actually have a piece that I've been meaning to polish off, talking about exactly that. Music is, in some ways, a much more direct and intuitive form of exactly this. That, like you said, notes really don't mean anything. And if you have perfect pitch, you can name it a note. But a note is really only meaningful in relation to the other notes. That's what it's that's what and as far as music is concerned, a note is really just its connection, and you can transpose up or down or whatever, and you have the same exact melody, right? It's the same melody. Just what do you mean in C minor? What does that mean, right? Well, because it's only about the actual relational structure. It's not a different song. It's the exact same song. It's the exact same melody, even if it's in, if the keys are all different. And so music is actually this remarkably pure form of pure relational encoding. I think there's some deep clues to the structure of the mind from music. People have long suspected this, and people have looked at music. It's very mysterious what on earth it is and why we love it so much and why it does what it does inside of us. And I think there's a deep clue in the autoregressive framework because it is this thing exactly. It's this relational structure that plays out over time where there's this prediction, right? One of the key aspects of music is that it has this catchiness to it. It's easily remembered, and there's a certain predictive quality to it, right? It's not just all over the map. If you're a musician in particular, if I give you a few bars of a melody, you might be able to continue that melody in a way that either is exactly right or makes sense, whatever that means, right? Well, what's that sense? It's because we've learned this kind of trajectory through the notes, that there's certain trajectories that make sense. And it's just like the language. There's certain trajectories that make sense. Certain words come after other words. And it's that relational structure that we end up learning when we learn how to speak and when we learn how to talk, when we learn how to understand. And so I think music is a very, very apt example. It's not even a metaphor. It's sort of the same fundamental principles, but in a very different domain. Music is a more pure form of it. In language, and you talked about meaning, and I just want to quickly mention this. Language, and people often object, well, what do you mean? Words, they have meaning. They talk about things in the world. And that is true, but in a very indirect sense. That's sort of the very subtle point here that's a little hard to get across. The large language models just learn certain relations. To them, it's just like music, literally just like music. They just learn the pure inherent relational structure. The same way you can't tell me what's a melody about. Right, make you feel a certain way, but it doesn't carry meaning outside of itself. To the large language models, that's what all of language is. It's just a relational structure. To us, there is also this other stuff going on. When I'm talking to you, when I say there's a certain object with certain properties, there are other things happening elsewhere in your brain. You might have imagery. You might have motor kind of processes. These are in concert with, they're coordinated with the linguistic system. And so there is extension to language. Language does other stuff inside your body, may make you later on reach for a certain object. In some mysterious way, this all does actually, like if I tell you something, it does have behavioral implications. And vice versa, when you see something or you hear somebody or whatever, you experience something, this has linguistic implications. But it's still ungrounded in the sense that, and this is the claim is it's still really operating entirely based on the same principles as the large language models. It's just music, but that music also makes people dance, or it makes people feel certain things, right? But the music itself has its own rules. And so that's why it's just a great metaphor. Not, again, not even a metaphor. The music is really kind of like, it's the pure example of a quote unquote meaningless structure for its own sake. I think language is the same thing. It's ungrounded in that sense that it operates based on its own rules, but it also has this kind of after effects, these auxiliary effects that give it its real utility.
That makes so much sense too, in light of, as SLPs, we work with kids and we see a lot of the language development process happening. And you could see how kids they sort of feel into the meaning of words before they have a direct, idea of what
Well,
they
and they
actually.
never, but that's the thing, and you say that, but we never end up with the idea, right? That's the myth, and exactly right. It's like the feeling into it. It's like they're learning how to operate within this physical and linguistic realm where this stuff happens together. but they're not actually learning definitions of words, and definitions end up failing miserably. And if we're thinking about teaching in terms of definitions, we're thinking about it wrong. And I think that's your deep intuition. I think that's why you reached out to me, because that is not actually like that's the way we think about teaching. It's like shove sort of more words or something into it. But instead, what you're really doing is you're learning how to operate behaviorally in this sensory linguistic sphere where both of these things are kind of interacting, but they're not the same thing. The words, they have their own their shape, and then the perceptual has its own shape, and then we learn how to coordinate within both of them.
I've had this kind of intuition for a long time that, no matter how many, you have a dictionary, like the classic, idea is that you have a word and then the dictionary has a list of definitions. But I've
Yes.
just felt, if you actually examine language as we have to do, we have to listen to a lot of language samples of kids, you realize that there's just not an apt characterization of a word at all is to have a list of definitions. There's like way both more possibility and also less possibility in some ways because it can only go in certain shapes, like you're saying. Like these words have like these particular relationships, and also, context really is everything.
That's
Like, and
context,
that.
exactly. The behavior, like the you mean the context, like not you don't just mean like linguistic context. You mean like the environmental context, like you're sitting in a room and you're like, can you get that for me? Right? Those words in and of itself, what on earth? That doesn't mean anything if you don't have all the other stuff, right? And then you realize, well, those words don't really mean what we think they mean. Can you get that for me? What are the, does that have a definition, right? Is those words going to map to anything meaningful out independent of the particular context? So it's exactly. I think that's you've clearly intuited, I think as a clinician, the strong limitations of sort of the classical way of thinking about language, and I don't know to what extent that is helping you to formulate interventions, but I'm dying to hear about that, honestly.
Well, I think for probably most clinicians now, at least the ones I work with, the traditional, like you teach this card and then, they learn that apple, that like this picture of an apple is an apple. It just doesn't really work because sometimes you can teach a kid. It's so funny. Like I've had so many times, especially with language testing, you have to test a definition of a word and a child can't give you the definition of the word. Like they seemingly don't know what it means. And then just 5 seconds later, they're using that word in a different
Right.
context,
Right.
correctly. It's so funny. It really shows that this is not
Yeah.
how we're learning language.
Right. And it's not, it's kind of almost not how we're learning anything. And it really gets this sort of this implicitness of cognition itself, is that it's just kind of running. Let's just focus on the case of language. When I'm producing words, or when a large language model is producing words, it's doing it in purely in this sort of this generative sense where the previous sequence is predicting the next word. There isn't any cognizance in the model at all of what the intent of any of those words are. It's just using the available information to generate. The prediction is implicit, it's inherent. Here's what another way to put it. And I talk about this in relation to knowledge. When I ask you, where are you from? Or, what did you do yesterday? There's this notion that what we're doing is we've got stored memories that contain information. There's this sort of like in these buffers, these memory buffers that contain facts. And we go and we retrieve those facts. And that's how a classic database actually works. So if you SQL, if you do people, do the kind of like database management, you literally have lists of facts. And then the trick is how do you retrieve the correct fact? That's not what happens at all in large language models. You'll ask them a question and they will give you the answer. And if you're lucky, in most cases, the answer will be correct. But that fact wasn't stored anywhere. This fact wasn't actually in there because the fact, like I say to a model, what is autoregression, right? And then it might give me a nice long sequence of words that you can't find that sequence anywhere in the model. It doesn't exist because, as you recall, it's just doing next token. It's just doing very one, and then it just does it over and over again. So what it really has is the potential, given the right input, it's going to produce this output, and then you run it, and it ultimately will produce this meaningful set of outputs. So what that means is that the model doesn't really know what autoregression is, and it's kind of weird to think about, right? And well, sure it does. It's responding appropriately. But if you were to look in the guts of this thing, if you were to able to decode all of the weights in this model, you're not going to find a definition of autoregression. It's not in there. The definition is not in there. And what you did, my claim is what you, Garrett, when I ask you, what did you do yesterday, you'll be able to tell me that answer. But if I were to, actually, shake your brain and peer at it with the greatest, kind of imaging technology, the answer is not actually in there. How does the answer emerge? It emerges because implicit in the structure of your brain is the ability to produce this kind of behavior. And so it's a very, very, it's sort of subtle, but it's a foundational difference, right? The knowledge isn't in there. The knowledge, your brain gets shaped over time to produce certain kinds of behaviors. And that can be a linguistic behavior, like telling me some fact, or it can be a behavior like doing something, knowing how to do a procedure, or do appropriately responding to somebody's request, all of these kinds of things. And so really gets to this idea that if you're thinking about teaching, shoving info, trying to say memorize this fact is exactly the wrong way to. The fact doesn't get in. No, condition people to respond appropriately to a given input. That's how you want to do it. And if you're thinking, well, then that's what I'm doing. I'm showing them a flashcard and they're supposed to produce this output. No. That's not how we operate in the real world. We don't produce those kinds of responses. We produce responses like, I want an apple. Can I have that apple? Apples are delicious. Put it into environmental contexts and settings where people would typically use it in this generative way, and I think you'd be much more likely to actually see success. And I think you see it, right? You say you've seen people, then they use the word, right? That's the thing. They don't know what they don't know what they're doing. It's kind of like it's kind of like this whole procedural memory, and people talk about this, right? Declarative. Maybe you've heard of this, a distinction between explicit and implicit memory. We don't know how to ride a bike. I can't tell you to ride a bike, but I know how to do it, right? My argument is that's true for everything. That's true for facts that you know. You don't know what you know. You just know how to do it. You know how to talk about your life. You know how to talk about speech therapy. You know how to talk about these things, but you don't really know what you know because you don't store these facts. You're conditioned over the course of learning to be able to talk about these things sensibly. And so it's to produce these behaviors.
Yeah, that's such a paradigm shifting way of thinking about it. And intuitively, it feels so correct. Like as a musician, when I'm playing jazz, for example, like the reason that I can play jazz is that because I have some, intuitive sense of, the shape of how things are going. I'm never like nothing I play in jazz. Well, maybe there are certain little chunks that I use over and over again, but like all of that is flexibly being produced. I talked recently to Dr. Safran, Dr. Jenny Safran. I don't know if you've heard of her.
Yeah, sure.
She did the statistical learning
Yeah,
in.
she's cited all over in my upcoming paper. Quick,
Oh, cool.
quick self promote. I have this paper I'm going to be putting out archive first. Archive is like it's going like a preprint, before peer review, but it's got a big section on and Safran's kind of work about statistical learning in
So
infants.
cool.
And if you man, you're intuiting. You want to do a PhD? You want to do a PhD with me? You're fantastic. But yes, so go on. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's so cool. That's so exciting. So, she was talking about the statistical properties of these, syllable boundaries. And I was just thinking as you were talking, like thinking of kind of language learning as this sort of higher dimensional statistical inference. So like you're kind of learning the shape of these dependencies, like she's talking about, very, small as you're learning, you can learn one, phonetic boundary, even just like here to there. But once you scale it up, you're kind of learning statistical regularities across this entire, and it's hard for me to, it's hard to think about like this high
It
dimensional
is.
space, but, that the space that includes in language, syntax and prosody and emotion and context and all these things that we might not think about. It kind of suggests that there are like, all of these hidden dimensions of language. Do you have a sense of, like, you know, what they might be, or how many there might be, or
Gosh, so there's something both beautiful and sort of brutally disappointing in some ways, when you really get down to the guts of what is going on in these large language models. And when I say disappointing, not because it's not incredibly rich. In some ways, it's ineffably rich. And what I mean by that is that you can actually make it very concrete. When you actually get down to what's going on, each word, I use this term token, and the tokenization process is you basically take, your big corpus. You've got a lot of words that get repeated and stuff, and you're turning each one of those words into a vector, which is just a list of numbers, right? It's just a string of numbers, and then you take those strings of numbers, and over the course of learning, you it was called embedding. You then take those words, you kind of expand them into a higher dimensional space. But all that really means in at a concrete level is that each one is going to get represented as just an even bigger number. And one way to think about that is each number is just, you can think of it as like a location in a space. So let's say you have a two-dimensional space, right? So you have, the two, X and Y axis. So if I give you two numbers, I say 3, 7, that's this point in the space. And 1, 2, that's this point in the space. And we could talk about how close together those are. Now, that's two dimensions. That's just, and it's demystifying, right? It's just two dimensions. What dimensions aren't these fancy things. It's just like how many addresses, right? If you have two dimensions, then this gives you two-dimensional space. Now just scale it up to, 100,000 or 1 million dimensions. You can't visualize it anymore, but it really is just that. It's just that you've got this big string of numbers, and we could say, okay, this particular number, 1, 3, 7, 9, 5, 4, 4, whatever, right? Just listed out a very long list. That tells you where you are in this space. And what happens in a large language model is it's forming, it's actually molding what this space looks like, such that the word apple falls somewhere in relation to the word orange. And it's also in relation to the word red and crunchy and sweet and whatever. And that these things are in the sort of the appropriate location relative to one another in this super high dimensional space. In some ways, that's it. That's what it means. The dimensions are these, in some ways, just or sort of the descriptions of words are just these numbers. It's purely numerical. It's incredibly abstract. At the same time, by doing so and by molding this thing in a way that allows it to do next token prediction, this space ends up taking on the shape, and that's the sort of the idea of the shape of language, the shape such that these words have the relations are meaningful, like they carry this kind of meaning that it ends up being useful for not just predicting the next token, but in a meaningful way. Right? Whatever we mean by that. What do we mean by that? Well, it's going to have this kind of behavioral implications. We're all going to agree that this is the right term. Whatever you want that meaning to be. So that's what I mean by, in some ways, it's actually brutally kind of base. It's kind of like, it's just vectors. It's just very abstract things. Yet it's extraordinarily rich because it's a super high dimensional and it's this crazy, crazy math of forming this, this shape of this space. But the disappointing part to me right now, at least, is like, well, what does that mean? What does that mean? What does it mean that red and apple have this relation to one another? I can't visualize it. I can't really, I could try to, you could actually try to measure their distance, but that's sort of actually compressing it all down to one simple measure. It's not really going to tell you almost anything. You could probably, make some predictions about that. And so in some ways, it is really hard to answer that question you asked, like, how many dimensions? Is there a better way to get a grasp of what the dimensions really are? And right now, my answer is, well, at least we've got a true concrete sort of map of what we mean by words. It's these high dimensional vectors in this high dimensional space that are shaped by this next token generation task. If you find that satisfying, great. But of course, you probably don't, and neither do I. It's like, what is the true insight there? The only insight I could say is, well, That's an operational deficient, and I think it's the same thing that the brain is doing. I think that's going on in neurons too. I think we're probably actually generating the brain is just this high dimensional space. It's a way of physiologically instantiating this kind of high dimensional space where you can parameterize stuff and change. Like this has this, right? When you tell me a word, it will have this particular activity in the brain that probably is very similar in some ways to this kind of vector representation. And then somehow the brain is taking that, and it's probably not exactly like an LM, and then producing all of this behavior. So you end up with math, but you want more, right? You want the music of the math. You want the intuition. You want to see it. You want to grasp it and feel it. And that's where I'm like, well, that's unfortunately right now, as far as I can tell, I've been actually working on visualization tools, thinking about these high dimensional trajectories and moving through them, do dimensionality reduction, and you end up with nice trajectories. And you're like, okay, but what is it? How does that tell me what an apple is? And it's hard. It's hard.
Yeah, there's the quote in your interview, something like, the fly knows something that the linguistic system will never know. There's just these things that are beyond
Yes,
words, so to
exactly.
speak.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm wondering, just as SLPs, we think a lot about language development, and you mentioned tokens. I was wondering, do you think that there's like kind of a developmental trajectory as we're kind of getting a grasp on the space and reconfiguring this space to better map to, is not the right word, but
Yeah,
sort of
that's
figure
good. So
out, but
shaping the space to produce
shaping the
flows.
space, right?
Yeah.
Do you think that there's like kind of a trajectory for what the brain considers a token? Thinking back to Jenny Safran's work, when we're an infant, we're kind of predicting at the level of phonemes, let's say, or syllables or something like that. And then there's some variability as we get older because young kids will consider like a whole chunk, like a phrase, like maybe a single word. Sometimes they're using words. And, as we get older, we kind of think in larger and larger chunks, maybe even at the narrative level, let's say, where we can, take parts of a narrative and then perhaps consider that a token. I don't know. Do you have
That
any
is
intuitions about that?
a spectacular question. So good that I just want to write it down and think about it. I haven't really given this sufficient thought yet, although I've given it a little bit of thought. So here's the thing, and you're touching on something very deep, I think, that really I don't think the field is grappled with yet, certainly in relation to thinking about how humans actually do this. So the weird thing about the very weird thing about sort of thinking about language this way is that you're like, what's a word? A word is not, in the case of these large language models, for example, it's this vector. And that doesn't have a sound. It's not written down. It doesn't have a certain shape of letters. It's nothing like that. It's just this particular string of vectors. And this purely abstract thing ends up being what you end up mapping, right? You say, this is going to be in this location. Or let me put it differently. What you do is you take a string, you take actual words, right? The sequence of words. And you turn those into these sort of abstract representations. Now, the tokenization scheme is a little bit arbitrary. There's various ways of doing it, but it kind of boils down to some extent to words. But you have things like prefixes and suffixes and things like that. And so, in the case of, and maybe this is a clue, in the case of like actual large language models, you do end up taking what we would traditionally call words and word components. Like, you don't take an arbitrary, you don't take
Morphemes.
yes, it maps pretty decently to morphemes, but you'd be surprised. Each tokenization scheme, sometimes you get strange stuff, like why is this particular construct, sometimes it'll take compound words, split them up, sometimes it won't, and things like that. It doesn't map very neatly to that. But that tokenization scheme is a way of saying, okay, this counts as a token. But again, once the model runs with it, it's sort of in some ways arbitrary. Like, okay, that's because we think that that's a reasonable way of characterizing what should go in and what we should map the relation between. You can force it to do it that way. But by the time it gets into the model, it's completely abstracted away, right, from that form. And so it's kind of an imposed structure. But when you think about actual language and certainly spoken language and the fact that there's, this phonetic component to it, we don't really know to what extent the brain is tokenizing in this way. We just have no idea. I think Safran's and work like that certainly points to subword kind of tokenization, if you want to call it that, at least in terms of certain kind of statistical learning. You can see it happening at a phoneme level. And then the question is, and this is, I think, your key question, is like, well, over time, do the tokens change, right? Do you start off with tokens, so to speak, being like really at the phoneme level or even subphoneme, right? It depends how thin you want to slice it. And then over time, you end up doing a retokenization, where it's now a word level, and then but then maybe phrase level, right? Things that tend to go together a lot maybe start to become the tokens. And by the way, you do see compound tokens in the tokenization schemes of large language models, where they can combine even separate words. So I think you're asking a really great question, that may. First of all, it may have implications for even thinking about how the AI does it, because right now it's one and done. You do the tokenization, and then you run the actual learning phase, where you do the high dimensional embedding with the next token generation. But what about going back and rebuilding your tokenization? Is it possible that maybe there are more optimal tokenization? And by the way, somebody may jump on me here and be like, no, you missed the last year of tokenization literature, because I'm not an expert in this. And in fact, we do kind of optimize tokens after the fact. I have a vague memory of maybe seeing something like that. But thinking about what counts as sort of the units, and then mapping them in and finding where they live, right, in the high dimensional space, there's just two distinct processes. And you're touching on the fact that in people, this probably is a developmental process, probably a shifting process. There probably isn't, it can't be sort of like a single tokenization scheme. There can't be, because you don't start up knowing what they are. That's sort of Safran's work, right? Is like, you need to first find out which phonemes get together before you can start making these compounds and say that's a word. And so you have to do that. But then once you've found those words, and so how on earth is this happening? Is it all using the same math? Like, do you first try to tokenize and then embed and then use that to do prediction and then go back again and retokenize? I think that's a fascinating kind of concept. I want to go check the literature like right away, to see what people have said about that. But it's a very interesting question.
It seems like in it's so cool to think about the language development process and getting to that point where you're, then language starts to maybe, or maybe it's always doing this, but I'm thinking about when babies are babbling, for example, they don't, they're not really, using the, the shape of their latent space is like,
Well, it's
there's
very different.
yeah, very
But there's
different.
probably something there, right? In utero, even you're getting
Sure.
you're certainly getting input that tells you quite a bit about the shape. And in studies that show, babies know sort of the cadences of their native language. So, at birth, and so it's happening really early on.
It's so cool. Yeah,
That's
I don't know if
curious.
you've heard of this, like when babies are born, they respond to the, particular time signature that they were bounced at.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So like if they prefer 3-4 if they like were bounced in different time signatures.
You mean like in utero, like they were?
Yes.
Oh, wow, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
Yes, perfect. Exactly. It's so yes, this stuff is happening. And then there's internal, the rhythmic processes that are entraining the system. So there's a lot of this self-entraining happening over the course of development, long, long before the baby's actually born. And so, yes, it's really, really hard to say that there's discrete processes. It's all a continuum.
Yeah, and I think again, just re-emphasize for SLPs, like we have to learn this high dimensional space and the shape of this space, and so it really isn't a matter of memorizing symbols, and it's not really even a matter of a lot of SLPs might teach like We have goals for like grammar. They have to learn the past tense form or something like that.
Oh,
They're, you know,
God.
you're, and it's like that's this is, you know, a complete flip. You know, we should be teaching in
I have a lot to say about
context.
that,
But yeah, just that, you know, really direct instruction and rule teaching, you know, I think we all sort of intuitively, after doing it for some time, you know that it's just not that effective. And you know, you sometimes you have to describe, you're teaching a kid, you're describing what this metaphor means, like it never gets through. You know, and we're really learning through this kind of more context-based experience with these, you know,
I
patterns,
mean,
right?
it's, and you know, people talk about experiential learning, and it can sound a little cliche, and maybe sometimes it is. We shouldn't think about it as just being, that you're embedded or things like that. It's no, it's that you need the flow. You kind of need the flow of how things actually happen, or maybe another way to put it is, you have to simulate what you're going to actually be doing. Rather than trying to stuff people information so that they can later use it, you have to try to get the same pattern. It's all about these patterns. It's about generative patterns. And to the extent that you can teach the pattern, right? Not teach the information, but teach the pattern. That's the fundamental, I think, fundamental insight here. That it's going to be like you mentioned syntax. Don't tell people about past tense, man. I can't tell you how absurd I think it is that we do that with to native language speakers, maybe for second language, probably not even there. This is something this was discovered after the fact. I'm going to go on record. I was going on record saying this before. Chomsky was wrong. Like syntax is, and it's an epiphenomenon. It's something we discovered in language, and it comes out somehow out of the computational process, but it's not actually how we do it at all. And the idea that we should teach that after the fact as a way to do it is just fundamentally wrong. Don't memorize conjugations, just use the phrases as you would use them, and that's how you learn it. And you learn it to do it like you mentioned earlier, like in context, right? I'm gonna say, well, what did Garrett say to me? Oh, Garrett was talking about this. Do it that way. Don't say, how do you say in the present and the future and all of that. That's just a terrible, terrible idea.
Oh, I 100% agree. And I think this also it's a another great reframe for therapists, like this in context learning. It's like we oh, so many times, you know, as when I was in working in the schools, for example, as it was a I was taking kids, you know, out of the classroom during their general education where they're, you know, getting this rich kind of context based language, taking them out into this decontextualized environment, you know, doing weird activities that they would not be doing otherwise.
Like
And it's like,
tests, test
right.
errors.
Well, yeah, right. So, you know, it's just remembering that I think reinforcing that also parents play a big role. You know, when you are doing speech therapy, it's good to, you know, this is a great reminder to implement those, you know, strategies that you might be using to help elicit language in the context of the home environment, in a routine, in something that they're doing a lot, just making sure that they have access to these, you know, patterns. And, you know, a lot, I think a lot of that subconscious machinery will turn on and get those patterns going. One thing that we're seeing a lot in the homes these days, and one thing I'm hoping to study is just the fact that there's so much decontextualized speech and noise coming from digital devices in the home and lots of iPad use and, you know, things that aren't interactive and often don't connect to, you know, something else that, you know, you're kind of learning. I guess if we're referencing this space, kind of learning the space in a strange way because it's you're probably not usually getting the right context. It's not, you know, something
Yeah,
that you're
I never
totally
thought about
attending
that before.
to. But I think that there's a ton of like almost like bad data input data in the homes now. And we've seen, you know, through the pandemic, for example, it was like a crazy increase. 120% increase in communication disorder, something like that. I'll have to check the numbers again, but you know, it's like more than doubled, I think, you know, and it's just been on the rise since we've had more access to devices in the home. Not to say that, you know, it's necessarily causation, but I think that there's something there.
No, I think so. It's a great point. And I've often sort of lamented social the kind of devices is you're not learning how to interact and make eye contact and all of that kind of good stuff. But it's a very cool insight you have is like that it's decontextualized language. It's not how it was meant to be generated. I mean that's true of books too on some level, but the idea is you need that grounding first so that the language has this kind of mapping to all the other stuff. And again, that's where meaning comes from. Meaning isn't like dictionary definition. It's not pointing to some sort of abstract apple in the world or anything like that, but it does have meaning in relation to what you do with the language. Like, and that's inherently interactive, and it's embodied and it's in the world and all of that good stuff. And disembodied, decontextualized language, I think you could really make the case is it's in its wrong form. It's not how nature intended it. And maybe an important insight into some of these deficits that you're talking about.
Yeah, I see a lot of kids who, more and more in my caseload, that it's just like when you speak with them, like the narratives don't make sense, and past the age that they should, and there's it's hard to, like, I can't understand, the topics are jumping all over, and these are often kids that I see like on devices in the home all the time. I wonder, because you're not getting that natural feedback for, when you're talking with a parent and you say something that's, oftentimes you're playing with the latent space, let's say, and you're, generate some random noise, right? And then if you're never getting feedback about what's natural and on topic, you're missing that dimension of the space.
Yeah, you need to see that your language does the thing that you wanted it to do.
Right.
Or it doesn't, and then you reform, as you say, you modify the shape so that you get the results you want. If you don't have that feedback, you don't know what to do with the shape, and then you end up with and we all especially in this early days, in these large language models, they can go off. Autoregression could do whatever it's going to run, but it could go off in bizarre directions. The language is no longer going to have the trajectories that are optimized for what they're supposed to do. So yeah, I think it's a definitely it's not even a metaphor. It's like you may really onto something of sort of a decontextualized language. I think it's really potentially a very very a severe threat kind of to the understanding and the operation of kids if they're getting too much of that.
Yeah, be weird to be in like sort of like a Tower of Babel situation where no one understands each other, which could happen. I'm wondering, just a couple more questions. Do you think that there are things that outside of autoregression in your theory that may constrain language? Like, I was thinking about, maybe emotion and affect as sort of maybe something that signals like a modulation, maybe the path of the autoregression. Something outside of the snake eating its tail that
Absolutely. Yes.
cool.
Yeah. I mean, and so. This is something that I try to get across, but I don't necessarily do the best job of it, which is although language operates, the argument is that language operates entirely based on its own inherent structure. There are other factors that act kind of like I call it like a prompt injection. So I'm in an environment, all right, a visual environment. That perceptual environment is going to cue, it's going to cue my language. It's kind of like an LLM. Let's say I type into my ChatGPT. I am sitting in a room, I'm looking at a screen, I'm talking to Garrett. These are all the situations that I'm getting maybe non-linguistically, but then end up injecting over this. This is a term that's actually used in the community, prompt injection. They end up in the linguistic stream. And so affect, mood, and these kinds of things. It's actually, I was doing some modeling with this. It's something that I have to get back to. But you can inject something like you're in a sad mood, or the user is in a sad mood, and it's going to impact the trajectory. It's going to impact the trajectory in a linguistic way, right? So that's the weird thing to think about is that the large language model has no idea what affect really is. It doesn't feel sad, but it knows what to do linguistically when you tell it linguistically, you're sad, right? And so I think that from a standpoint of thinking about So these one of my graduate students actually is working on something quite similar in relation to sort of extra linguistic kinds of and not mood per se, but other extra linguistic kind of things that can impact the linguistic generation. And so yes, there's a myriad of them, right? And I mentioned before that the language can certainly impact, like I can tell you to do something and you know or somebody to, something and it'll impact with their behavior, right? It goes outside of language and jumps into their muscles, right? It's making them do things. But as I pointed out, it goes both ways. There's all kinds of other stuff that's going on in our body, perceptual, affect, hormonal, digestive, you name it, that are going to impact the linguistic trajectory. And so the key insight, though, is that, you know, again, according to my claim, is that it's still running on the same next token prediction, purely linguistic internally. It doesn't know about anything. The linguistic system, it has no computational, there's no direct representation of those body states. They have to be turned into a linguistic description in some form. But then once they do that, that will definitely guide the trajectory. So you certainly can have lots and lots of stuff that it's not just a snake eating its tail, or if it is a snake eating its tail, it's potentially something nudging its tail into its mouth in a different direction, if you want to
Yeah.
think about it. Maybe I've gone too far with this metaphor.
Yeah. This is a just something popped up for me. Have you heard of this like neuropathological research where I think I read this in Ian McGilchrist's work where it's like, the right hemisphere is offline and the language system, ostensibly it's just the language system that's running. And these patients have to do a task where they it's sort of like these little logic puzzles, but it's like, they'll see something like the Sahara is freezing, the Sahara is a desert or something, and then like, see, is this true or false? The Sahara has a lot of ice, in it. And someone with a functioning right hemisphere will say, the Sahara is not cold. That doesn't make any sense. Your premises are false. But the patient who has a right hemisphere stroke will never say that. They'll just base it on whatever premises they're given, and then they'll follow the logic to its conclusion. Is that something like sort of this like linguistic, hermetically sealed language system? Is that
I think that's a that
something
is
that's going
a
on?
fantastic account of that kind of man. I can't tell you how many times I've said I gotta read because so many people point me to it. I have a very superficial notion. But yes, what you're describing sounds exactly like if you were to say just run with this linguistically, you can do it. You can give it any premise to a large language model, and especially if you just if you prompt it appropriately and say just run with this, it can go in any direction you want. There is a trajectory that's sort of the best one given these words, but then there's the connection, as you're pointing out, in the rest of us, there's other stuff that happens, and it all happens in concert. So when you talk about the Sahara being freezing, like I have when you say the Sahara, immediately I also have a visual image, this visual image of a desert, and when you say it's freezing, my visual imagery is like broken, right? And so that could easily produce a feedback to my language model and say, no, that doesn't make any sense. But it's the visual that figured out it doesn't make any sense, not the language necessarily, but you have this kind of cross communication. And so there's this dance that's happening. It's there isn't none of these are they may be computationally modular in the sense that I mean that language ultimately is doing next token prediction from its own geometry. But it's getting inputs from the other modalities and thinking more broadly, right? Not, thinking isn't, even if we're thinking like now we're talking, we're kind of thinking linguistically. But you just said it before, something popped into your mind, right? What the hell is that, right? It wasn't necessarily a linguistic thought. It could have been a visual thought or some other modality. Maybe you're like, it's getting late, it's getting dark, whatever it is, other stuff. That then goes and impinges on the linguistic process. So yes, absolutely. There you can think. I love the hermetically sealed linguistic process as kind of in some ways deficient, right? And it comes back to the point you made earlier about like devices, right? Like it's not meant to be run without getting consistent feedback from these other systems. It's not really meant to run on its own. It's internally defined, but it's not supposed to be by itself.
And it's amazing that you can get to situation almost where language becomes so dominant that it loses touch with the rest of experience, which I
And that's
consider
the point about the
primary.
fly. And that's the point about the fly. And that's
Yeah.
sort of deeper, you know, if you want to get metaphysical, cosmic, religious, even about all of this, it's like, yes, if we get to go too far, and I think maybe, you know, I don't know if this is the appropriate context. Probably not what you usually talk about in this podcast, but yes, as a society, as a civilization, you know, rationalism and all these things in some ways are really, really, really extremist about language. If you think about it, because irrational, like literally means that you can just can express it symbolically. That's kind of what is a ratio, right? It's kind of and so it's symbolic. And if you lose touch with the other stuff, then maybe you end up in some strange attractors that aren't actually optimal, like level.
It seems such a like a you know I think this is really important to talk about. It's
Good.
something I think about too. But you know, given this framework of thinking about this, you can see how easy it is to fool yourself into thinking that something is correct without when you go too far down a linguistic rabbit hole. You know, it's easy to
Not
become
to mention rabbit holes, right? And like misinformation and like all this kind of stuff. Actually, I think I had a posting about this somewhere on, I don't know if it was on X or Substack, I don't remember, but like propaganda and these kinds of things, what they're really doing is not necessarily convince you of a fact, but it's getting the certain pattern to run. And that those could be pathological. You get somebody to like the brain to go in a certain trajectory, a certain rabbit hole, that maybe, you know, it's too self-guided. It loses touch. And maybe rabbit hole, I never thought about rabbit hole that way, but like it's underground. It's like there's no sunlight there. It's just you're just in the hole. Like you're not getting feedback from anything else. So you definitely it's a really good metaphor. It's a linguistic rabbit hole is a perfect metaphor.
And thank you. Well, thank you so much for discussing this with the audience. I think it's so important and it's so cool. I mean, that there's so many both practical and, you know, important sort of metaphysical takeaways from your theory. What are you most excited about now? Like, what do you think needs to be studied?
So I have there's a lot here that needs to be sort of shored up in terms of the mapping between you know the theoretical claim in relation to the large language models and the brain and behavior. So what I really am hoping to do next is to make this very concrete in terms of true prediction. You know, the theory is really ultimately only as good as the predictions that it can make. Right now, I think it's a very good account. You know, Darwin took what was, you know, a big mess of biology you know, that didn't really have any any why behind it, and said, "Here's the why. I'll tell you the why," and it made a ton of sense. But until it made novel predictions about what should happen, you know, he had his finches and things like this. It really couldn't really be said to really stand as a true scientific theory. That's what I need to do, or I need others to help me do, is to the and this part of the paper that I'm planning on putting out there soon. The paper's mostly here's what we know, here's how this theory sort of accounts for already existing knowledge, and I think it wraps up a lot. I think it might convince a lot of people who might right now be skeptical, but what I'm really pumped about. And what I feel is almost like my intellectual obligation is to say, well, okay, great, you've accounted for existing phenomena. What else you got? What novel predictions does this make that we didn't have before? And I've been thinking a lot about, and it's a longer conversation, but a lot about my account, and this is in the paper. All this leads to a completely different idea of what memory is, and certainly short-term memory working. What's commonly referred to as working memory in you know in cognitive psychology. This is a different account. It has to do with basically memory isn't a storage and retrieval. It's that what you've talked about in the past is or what you've recently discussed is guiding generation. It's guided generation. And I think that a mathematical equation of this kind of decaying guided generation is going to lead to very different predictions. and related very much to the things we've been talking about, not memorization tasks. This is foolishness. The way we've been studying memory is wrong. It's just like the way people are teaching is wrong in the context that we've discussed. People don't memorize sequences of things to regurgitate. We have to be thinking in terms of how does what we've you and I have been talking in the last 10 seconds, how is that guiding what I'm saying now? How about a minute ago? How about 10 minutes ago? So I think what I'm really excited about is a crystallization of a sort of mathematical formulation that we can now capture in terms of the guided generation. So I think that I'm hopeful I'm going to be able to make some novel predictions that we can capture in a new way of studying behavior, frankly, a new way of studying memory behavior as guided generation rather than retrieval. And then if that holds up, lo and behold, we have a completely different predictive framework. And by the way, that'll help us, of course, to think about things like pathology. What are memory deficits really? What is actually happening during MCI or Alzheimer's? What kind of tests do we have, maybe for guided generation tests rather than retrieval tests? And so I'm very excited about this framework as making both novel predictions and novel kind of frameworks for actually studying behavior, understanding behavior, and also understanding pathology.
Well, yeah, I'd love to help in any way I can with, intervention and diagnosis. I feel like that might be, something that could really, really change a lot of things for clinicians and for patients to make treatment more effective. And yeah, I think
It's
that's
awesome.
really
I'll
exciting.
let you do it. I
Beautiful.
would love to be in touch about that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Barinholtz. You're really an inspiration, and thank you for just revealing an important part of the mystery that lies beyond the words we speak. If any people want to get involved, is there a place they can find you?
Oh, you could easily find my email address. I'm out, Elon Baron. I don't believe there's another Elon Baron. We talk about those specific points in space and namespace. I got my unique little point. Elon
Nice.
Barinholtz, you can find me. But if you want to, I'm also on Twitter on X. You can find me there. You can find me on Substack also, and respond to if you want to see some of my writings, sort of more general writings, not academic. I mean, well, they're academic, but you know what I mean. Not in jargony journal kind of language. Yeah, send me an email. Easy to find. And I'd love to hear from people who are taking these ideas maybe to some of their next logical conclusions. That would be utterly thrilling to me.
Fantastic. All right, everyone. Take care, stay curious, and hope to see you in the next episode.